Ukraine has stopped supplying Europe with natural gas from Russia in the middle of winter.
For Ukraine, this is a major point, that any income to Russia somehow helps the war effort.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. On today's show, what a stoppage of Russian gas means for all parties involved. Also, a suspected attacker claims to be inspired by ISIS. But what is the current status of the group?
And bullfighters in Costa Rica are not aiming to kill. They're just trying to get out of the bull's way, but it is still a controversial sport.
I don't think it's humane playing with a being that evidently doesn't want to be there. I mean, I don't think they're enjoying it.
Plus, 100 is the new 60, so said the world's oldest Olympian.
That's all ahead today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for joining us this Thursday, the second day of January.
We begin today's program with the news from New Orleans, where a pickup truck plowed through a crowd of revelers early yesterday morning, killing at least 14 people. The suspect, Shamsuddin Jabbar, died in a shootout with police.
At a press conference this morning, Christopher Rea of the FBI's counterterrorism division said that in videos posted to Facebook shortly before the attack, Jabbar claimed he was inspired by the Islamic State group, also known as ISIS.
In the first video, Jabbar explains he originally planned to harm his family and friends, but was concerned the news headlines would not focus on the, quote, war between the believers and the disbelievers, end quote.
Rea added that an ISIS flag was also found in the suspect's vehicle, along with explosive devices. At this point, it's believed Jabbar acted alone, but with so many questions about ISIS over the past day or so, we wanted to check in on the status of the Islamic State group as of 2025. For that, we turn to Aaron Zellin, a senior fellow at the Washington Institute.
From their perspective, they're trying to implement Islamic law based off of their interpretations, of course, all throughout the world, not just in Iraq and Syria or Afghanistan or parts of Africa, but they literally want to take over the whole world and implement it.
So the suspect in this attack in New Orleans said he joined the group. Help us understand what that means.
From the Islamic State's perspective, you don't necessarily need to go to a war zone to join the organization. There's also another avenue to do that. And from them, based off of their instructions, telling people to follow these particular methodologies, that if you do an attack on their behalf, that you then become a member of the group, essentially, that you become a soldier of the caliphate or a soldier of the Islamic State, as they've said in other claims of responsibility for attacks outside of war zones. And one of the indications of this is that this individual had an Islamic State flag in his car. And that's one of the instructions, among others, that the Islamic State has given to supporters previously.
So it scans generally with how you've been thinking about ISIS since they were largely defeated in the late 2010s.
Yeah, I mean, they lost their territory in Iraq and Syria in 2019. However, the insurgency in both those countries never actually ended. They continue to conduct attacks in both those countries to this day. But they've also diversified and getting stronger in places like sub-Saharan Africa. They've also built up a huge network for attacks abroad from Afghanistan. And we've seen this in attacks in 2024, say in, you know, Iran, Turkey, Russia. We also saw a smaller attack in Germany at the end of last summer.
Yeah, and in Syria especially, the last month has just been so transformative. What do you see in terms of ISIS and Syria right now?
So far, since the new government has come into power and the overthrow of the old regime, the Islamic State has not been able to take advantage of this new environment, at least not yet. The amount of attacks that they've conducted is commensurate with what we've seen over the last year or so. It's still relatively small in scale. Part of this is because the U.S. and the Global Coalition remain in Iraq and Syria, so they've been able to make sure that they don't get above a certain level. It's also important to remember that the group that took over Syria, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, has also been independently on their own fighting the Islamic State too, because the two groups had been fighting each other going back to 2014 during the Syrian civil war.
So, Aaron, at this point, is the Islamic State group more an organization, an ideology, or kind of equal parts of both? I mean, does it have command and control?
Yes, it's very much still an entity that is connected to one another. One of the things that it did actually after it lost territory in Syria following 2019 was to develop this new apparatus within the Islamic State called the General Directorate of Provinces. And essentially, it was a way to coordinate better and integrate better all of its so-called provinces globally. And that's in some ways the reason why we've seen a higher pace of attacks outside of these war zones in the last year or two, is because there's greater coordination amongst these so-called provinces.
So it really sounds like countering IS, it sounds like a game of whack-a-mole. I wonder, given the spread of IS and offshoots, is there some sort of fundamental rethinking around who and what they've evolved into?
I think a lot of it just comes down to more and more coordination across the board between different countries. We've seen this for the most part, especially amongst Western countries. Of course, there was this attack in New Orleans and a stabbing attack in Germany last year in the summer. But overall, most law enforcement in the West have been able to stop these plots and attacks in a way that is more successful than we saw even a decade ago when we saw the initial campaign by the Islamic State out of these territories. One of the biggest issues, because we're now in this era where there's more focus on power competition with other regional countries or other powers like Russia, is that there's not as much working together on these counterterrorism issues anymore. It's important to recall that the attacks in Iran and Russia last year, the U.S. actually warned both those countries ahead of time, but they didn't trust the information from the U.S.
Aaron Zellin is a senior fellow at the Washington Institute.
In Europe this winter, just as demand for heat increases, natural gas from Russia has stopped flowing to European countries via Ukraine. That's because the Ukrainian government allowed a five-year pipeline deal with the Kremlin to expire with the new year. The impact of reduced energy supplies when demand is high is going to hurt, but the pain will vary from one country to another, as Arild Moe can explain. He's a research professor at the Fridtjof Nansen Institute near Oslo, Norway.
Three countries will be particularly affected, and that is Austria, Slovakia, and Moldova.
And what do we know about how they're being impacted so far and how they are responding?
This end of the pipeline exports via Ukraine does not come as a surprise. It has been talked about for a while. And in Austria, they have made preparations, secured other supply contracts, and seem to be quite relaxed. In Slovakia, they can readily buy gas from other sources, but it will become much more expensive, and they are making a lot of noise about that. In Moldova, the situation is very different. They don't have readily other supply possibilities and are dependent on Russian gas to fuel a power station.
I was reading about the breakaway Russian-speaking region in Moldova where heat and electricity have been turned off. Did I get that right?
Yes, they are seriously affected. The pipeline gas is coming into Moldova in the Transnistria Autonomous Region, basically fueling this huge power station there. So they are feeling a lot of problems, but also the rest of Moldova is supplied via this power station.
So many European countries really reduced their reliance on gas from Russia in 2022 following the country's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. Why did Ukrainians wait for so long to shut off the pipeline that travels through their own country?
Ukraine has been very insistent that they are not breaking any contracts and the contractual obligations. And they have maintained that as long as this contract is in force, they will honor it. Also, it's important for Ukraine that this gas goes to countries in Europe that have had contracts with Russia. Ukraine would not be seen as creating problems for these countries by breaching a contract.
So by allowing this contract to expire and not renewing it, Ukraine is losing out on significant money, right?
Yes, they have received maybe approximately $800 million for the transit of Russian gas. But it has to be recalled that the main reduction in exports via Ukraine took place already in 2022-2023. So altogether, Russian pipeline exports to Europe have been reduced by 80% before these last volumes are being cut.
And that was $800 million, you said, so almost $1 billion?
Yes, that was approximately the fees that Ukraine has received from Russia to transit the gas.
So remind us currently where Europe is getting most of its gas from, if it has already reduced its reliance on Russian gas by 80%.
Norway is the biggest supplier of natural gas to Europe. But Europe has indigenous production in several countries, but also increasingly importing LNG from North Africa and from the Middle East, and not least from the United States.
LNG, liquefied natural gas.
Yes.
We've talked about the cost to Ukraine of this pipeline being shut down. How much is it expected to cost Russia and the energy company Gazprom?
Gazprom has had a big loss because of the already drastic reduction in exports. It's estimated that these volumes, which have been sold via Ukraine, has given them approximately maybe $5-6 billion of revenue, which is quite significant, and a significant share of their total income. So Gazprom already has quite significant financial problems, and this adds to their quite difficult situation.
Arild Moe is a research professor at the Fridtjof Nansen Institute near Oslo, Norway.
The Olympic world is mourning its oldest alum today. Agnes Kelletti, a Hungarian gymnast from the 1950s, died this morning in Budapest. She was 103 years old. According to the International Olympic Committee, Kelletti had been admitted to the hospital with pneumonia on Christmas Day. The world's Bianca Hillier remembers her life in and out of competition.
Grainy black and white footage shows Kelletti twirling on a balance beam and flipping over the uneven bars. She first competed in the 1952 Games in Helsinki.
The celebrations of the 15th Olympiad bring the time-honored Games to Finland for the first time.
And she returned in 1956 for the Melbourne Olympics. Footage shows Kelletti there marching in the opening ceremony. In total, Kelletti won 10 Olympic medals, including 5 gold medals, and she did it later in life than most gymnasts. While many of the sport's top athletes are teenagers, Kelletti hit her stride at 35. Speaking to the press on her 99th birthday, she gave insight into her secret: less pressure.
It's not the medals that are significant, but the experiences that came with them.
Kelletti said one of the main reasons she pursued gymnastics is because it allowed her to see the world. Her life had been put on hold in 1941, when at 20 years old, she was barred from competing due to her Jewish heritage. Kelletti escaped deportation to Nazi death camps by hiding in a village south of Budapest with false papers, as she told an English-language TV program called Fair Game.
After the Nazis invaded Hungary, I managed to buy the identification papers of a Christian girl. She was around the same age as me. I stayed in a remote village where nobody knew me, and I found work as a maid.
Her father and several relatives died in Auschwitz, never knowing the Olympic fame Kelletti would achieve. After retiring from competition in the late 1950s, Kelletti lived in Israel, where she married and had 2 children. She worked as a physical education teacher and coached the Israeli national gymnastics team. Kelletti herself could do the splits well into her 90s, and she had a party on her 100th birthday. "100 years old is exactly as 60 was for me," she said, adding, "I like to live, and I wish everyone good health." In her final years, Kelletti returned to her native country of Hungary, where she died early this morning. Kelletti's family says they still hope to celebrate what would have been her 104th birthday next week. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
We'll be right back. You're with The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. In Japan, the phenomenon is common enough to have its own word, kodokushi, meaning lonely deaths or people dying alone. The deceased often go undiscovered for weeks, sometimes even months. According to current estimates, around 68,000 people die alone each year in Japan. Increasingly, the aging population there is cut off from the rest of society. Reporter Rebecca Rossman recently visited a housing complex just outside of Tokyo where one resident has been tackling the problem head on.
92-year-old Aiko Oshima is ruffling through her neighbor's mailboxes.
How often is she checking the mail?
But Oshima, who stands at less than 5 feet tall and weighs about 90 pounds, isn't here to snoop. If a mailbox gets too full, that's when she knows it's time to knock on that neighbor's door. Oshima is a longtime resident at Tokiwadera, a giant housing complex just south of Tokyo. Over half of the 8,000 residents here are over the age of 65. Around 1,000 of them live alone. Oshima explains that these mailbox checks are part of a routine she started 20 years ago after a series of tragic deaths in the complex. One man's body wasn't discovered for 3 years. His bills were being paid automatically every month through his bank account. It wasn't until his savings ran out that authorities came to his apartment and discovered his skeleton. Oshima says that was a turning point. So as deputy head of Tokiwadera's Residents Association, she launched a hotline for concerned neighbors to report concerns and set up volunteer patrols to keep an eye on residents' movements. If someone's laundry is left on their balcony for too long or mail is left uncollected, it's time for a check-in. This year, the complex added a new tool, the Kizuna Call. It's a device equipped with sensors that tells you when a resident is moving around their apartment. Still, Tokiwadera has earned the somber nickname as the Estate of Lonely Deaths. That's why Oshima has been working tirelessly to foster community. She shows me around this volunteer-run cafe where residents gather to socialize.
Okay, I'll take a coffee.
Hideko Honda is one of the volunteers here. She tells me she moved here 15 years ago because there were so many vacancies, which made it affordable. But she admits it's been lonely. That's why she started volunteering in the cafe and has been encouraging her friends to do the same. For those that don't want to go out, she video calls them to check in. After the coffee break, Oshima walks me back to her office. I ask her a blunt question. What happens when she's gone? I have no clue, she says. She hasn't found a successor, and government support has been minimal, just a one-time payment of about $3,000. Oshima herself has lived alone for 30 years. Her husband died in the mid-90s. Her son, who lives far away, visits once a week to bring her food. But Oshima insists she isn't lonely. I'm too busy, she says. But with no successor to carry on her work, the question remains. Who will look out for the thousands of others living alone in Tokiwadera and across Japan? For The World, I'm Rebecca Rossman, Tokiwadera Housing Complex, Japan.
Nearly a decade ago, Norway set an energy goal that many thought was unrealistic. All new cars sold by 2025 would be electric. But the country is getting impressively close. Last year, 9 out of 10 new cars sold in Norway were, in fact, EVs. Felix Hammer watches the EV market closely. He's an electric vehicle charging consultant based in Amsterdam.
I think it really shows that policies work. So a long time ago, Norway set on this path to go full electric, and it is actually paying off in a way that nobody is even considering other means anymore. And you could also see that several car brands themselves, or at least their dealerships in Norway, decided, some of them already a year ago, to just pack the showroom with full BEV vehicles only. So yeah, you can really see that everything in Norway is just set up for electrification. The chargers are there, the pricing is right. It all makes sense.
Can you tell me what specifically the government is incentivizing? How is it making EVs more competitive?
Yeah, so the main way to do this is by the penalizing the fossils. So there is a huge tax if you buy a vehicle without a battery. So the price competition is just not there. If you compare a Tesla to a German car without a battery, then we're looking at things like double the price, and that's just the purchase. And then, of course, there will be other costs involved that will make the TCO even higher. But just this, yeah, from the purchase perspective, it's just very simple. The electrics is the only way.
So there are high taxes on petrol and diesel cars in Norway, and then EVs are exempted from import and value-added taxes. And you're saying that makes internal combustion engine cars twice as expensive in Norway?
Easy. I would believe three times the price difference. It is absurd.
Wow. And then once you own the car, things like tolls and ferries are cheaper for EVs, right?
So in the old days, there were really a lot of exempt places, and also you could even use bus lanes and stuff, but clearly that bus lane became way too busy. So a lot of these things are already normalizing.
You've also mentioned that charging infrastructure is in good shape. How did Norway get there?
Norway has been playing this game for so long that it's already a place where you actually have to replace a lot of infrastructure, because a fast charger from 10 years ago is not fast anymore in today's landscape. So things are changing fast. You can visit a charging site 5 years ago and today, and it will still be there, but it will be bigger, it will be faster, might even be cheaper. So yeah, there's a lot of things at play.
Are other European countries taking some lessons learned from Norway and implementing some of the policies themselves?
If we look at my own country here in the Netherlands, policies are actually already slowing down. So fossil became more competitive again this year because they aren't pushing the right policies through. They are not seeing sort of the end of the tunnel. So we're sort of in the middle of the tunnel again. And you can see this in many European markets where the right incentives aren't there. So how are you going to push for more electrification when that isn't the most obvious thing in some of these places that rely on a lot of fossil car production?
Felix Hammer is an EV charging consultant. He spoke to us from Amsterdam. More stories from around the globe are still coming your way this hour. You're with The World. There will be an election this year in Myanmar, but people are not getting their hopes up about what that means.
It may not be free and fair in any sense.
And bullfighters in Costa Rica, members of the public, can hop in the ring. They're known as improvisers.
Are you an improviser?
Yeah.
How many drinks has he had today?
Oi!
Still ahead on The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. When exactly a hunger crisis is recognized as a full-blown famine hinges largely on the assessments of an organization called the IPC, the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification. A bureaucratic-sounding name, but its findings have life-or-death implications. In Sudan, where the ongoing war has brought on a humanitarian crisis of vast proportions, the IPC has said that there is a famine, and what's more, it's spreading. But the National Army that controls Sudan's government rejects any notion that a famine's playing out there, let alone getting worse. Khalud Kher is a founder of the Confluence Advisory, a Sudanese think tank that was based in Khartoum until the war started in 2023.
The effects of this famine and how easy to see the evidence of this famine, I think, have made it so difficult for the IPC not to release findings that the famine is spreading. They first released findings to say that famine was visible and evidenced in one part of the country, an IDP camp, an internally displaced persons camp, in one part of the country, in Darfur. But in the past 2 weeks, they've come out with another report to say that famine has spread throughout the country. And it is this finding that the Sudanese armed forces and the de facto government are rejecting. But I think anybody, whether they're on the ground or have been following this, particularly Sudanese people who have been calling people back home and understand, you know, just exactly how this is playing out, cannot deny that famine is happening and it's spreading far more, I would say, than what the findings show.
I just want to get a sense of the magnitude of the situation first. What does hunger in Sudan look like right now?
It largely depends on where you are. If you live in a place very close to the front line, very close to the battlefield, it can mean total absence of food, or it can mean food from local markets that are frankly inaccessible, for example, are being bombed or being shelled by the two main belligerent parties, or it can mean food that is largely too expensive for people who, you have to remember, almost 2 years haven't had any access to their usual livelihood. In other parts of the country where there is what some people call safe areas, it can mean vast inflation. And so food is simply inaccessible for a lot of people. Just recently, the de facto government, which is basically the Sudanese armed forces and its allies, also introduced a new currency. So for a lot of people holding the old currency, it's very difficult to access money, let alone food itself. But in total, observers, particularly famine experts, have said Sudan is facing the largest famine in the world today, and possibly the largest famine that the world has seen in 40 years.
That is extraordinary. Holud, you began to sketch it out there, but can you elaborate more on how specifically the ongoing war between Sudan's National Army and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, the RSF, how that has created conditions for widespread hunger on the ground there?
Well, famine and war are very intertwined in Sudan's history of warfare. Every time there has been a war, a famine has followed. Now, Sudan is ordinarily quite self-sufficient. It has very large arable land that is farmable land. What we have seen warring parties do, particularly state parties, is use famine as a weapon of war. We have two main belligerent parties here who are part of the state. And they use famine effectively as a very cheap and effective way to kill a lot of people.
Why is the National Army of Sudan denying that there is a famine and that it's growing?
So for two reasons. One, they feel that it looks very poorly on them. They've been working very hard to try to convince global powers, regional powers, neighbors that they are the authorities, despite the fact that there's no constitutional basis for any of their authority following their own coup in 2021. And they feel that the famine declaration basically shows their inability to provide services that government are meant to provide. Second thing is that they believe that it might be used as a pretext by the UN and international actors as a way of intervening in Sudan, perhaps militarily. So they see it as an attack on their sovereignty, and they see very much sovereignty as a right rather than responsibility.
Holud, wasn't it the National Army, though, that actually allowed journalists to Port Sudan and Khartoum, where they witnessed signs of famine months ago?
They have been trying to get the capital of Khartoum back into their hands, and they have been making some incremental gains. Because of that, they have been inviting a lot of journalists whom they had previously banned into the country to see their successes. But of course, journalists are picking up on everything else as well, especially the scale of hunger and devastation. Now, the Sudanese armed forces would like the journalists only to pick up on hunger where it is under the control of the rapid support forces, because part of the starvation tactics and the policy of using starvation as a weapon of war is to create a governance crisis for your enemy. So for the Sudanese armed forces, limiting aid and food that gets into RSF-controlled areas would create a crisis for the RSF, where people within their areas would fight against them and say that you're not providing us services and undermine their control. So this all plays into that. And any journalist really who's willing to report the truth effectively becomes a threat. So we may see journalistic access decrease as a result of this famine declaration.
What have aid groups tried to do to pressure the government to let humanitarian aid in to deal with widespread hunger and now officially famine?
Frankly speaking, not enough. I mean, part of the problem in much of this, and this is not just sort of in relation to the famine, but in relation to getting aid of all types, particularly medical aid, into the country, is that the United Nations, which very much leads on the humanitarian front, is choosing to view the Sudanese armed forces as a de facto authority. So what that means is that it effectively cedes control over humanitarian provision to one of the belligerent parties that effectively allows the belligerent parties to dictate the terms of aid, which, as you can imagine, is completely unproductive. And what it gives then is particularly the Sudanese armed forces the space to say, well, we are the ones, we are the arbiters effectively of who gets aid and who does not. The lion's share of humanitarian provision, particularly in terms of food aid, has been delivered by humanitarian actors working on the ground, mutual aid groups effectively made up of a network of volunteers. The United Nations and humanitarian actors, frankly, have not been up to par, have not been able to meet the moment in terms of the world's largest humanitarian hunger, a displacement and protection crisis.
Holud Hare is the founder of the Confluence Advisory, a Sudanese think tank. She joined us today from London.
In Myanmar, military leaders say there's going to be an election this year, which is a bit surprising considering these are the same leaders who seized power from an elected government 4 years ago. Observers are not optimistic that an election in Myanmar will be free and fair. But as the World's Patrick Wynn reports from Bangkok, a proposed election could suggest that military rule is weakening after years of rebellion against it.
Another day, another humiliation for Myanmar's military regime. A long line of grim-faced troops, hands bound by rope, surrendering to resistance forces along Myanmar's western coast. In this footage, posted by the resistance, many regime troops look poorly fed. Some hobble on makeshift canes.
Surrendering is a good thing and a great thing.
Nini Lin hails from this coastal stretch of Myanmar, known as Arakan. He's thrilled that troops are surrendering left and right.
If they keep fighting under the military dictatorship, we can't guarantee their life.
By we, he means the Arakan Army, one of the dozens of revolutionary groups grinding down the military in different parts of the country. Nini Lin keeps in close contact with the Arakan Army, which is pulling off something incredible. It has seized the entire border with Bangladesh and almost the whole region around it, a green and marshy area about the size of Switzerland. Nini Wen is Arakan, an ethnic group with its own language and culture. He says his people want what all ethnic minorities in Myanmar are fighting for.
They want to liberate, they want freedom, they want to manage their own territory. So now it is happening.
On any map, Myanmar looks like this big, cohesive country. Bigger than France, wedged between India and China, also touching Bangladesh and Thailand. But it is no longer cohesive at all. Resistance groups estimate that the military controls just half the country's territory, if that. The regime's leader, General Min Aung Hlaing, admits in his latest speech that large areas are now run by, in his words, warlords. The general says these insurgents know if proper rule came back, they couldn't bully our citizens. They're committing naughty acts. His solution is to hold an election later this year. Of course, only regime-approved candidates can run.
It may not be free and fair in any sense.
Ong Kong Myat is a political analyst from Myanmar, pursuing his PhD at McGill University in Canada. He says almost no one thinks the election would be legit. For starters, the regime can't convince the armed groups that they are actively bombing to let them run polling stations in liberated areas. So why have an election?
This is the only way that they are going to get back the recognitions of important neighbors, especially China and India.
India and China support the regime. Both have big investments in Myanmar, from highways to ports to gas pipelines, and they want stability.
These countries see elections as a way for Myanmar back onto the path to reconnecting with the international community.
Both India and China are betting on the regime to hold the country together. But that's a risky play when the regime's leaders keep losing to the resistance. That's a brigadier general from the regime recording a video for soldiers still in the fight. Named Cha Cha Tan, he urges troops to wave the white flag and not die for incompetent leaders. He surrendered to the Arakan Army, which, like other resistance groups, welcomes defectors with open arms. Come out, come out, says an Arakan Army soldier to surrendering regime troops as the resistance storms one of their strongholds. Captured soldiers are sent home or allowed to stay in rebel areas. The Arakan Army has a plan. It's already set up its own courts, police, schools, its own state, basically. So have other resistance groups. I ask Ni Ni Nguyen from Arakan, are his people starting their own country?
At the present time, we are trying to maintain within Myanmar.
Meaning, the goal is one day, when all the country's ethnic groups defeat the military, they can unite, form a federal republic, and hold the country intact.
And then we can have a sit down and declare a new Myanmar.
But if the military regime persists and prevents the sit down, that's another story.
If it keeps going on like this, we will have no choice. We have to start our own country, our own nation.
The risk of Myanmar shattering into many states, some in the mountains, some by the coast, is very real. But hardly anyone thinks the regime can glue the country back together with an election. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen, Bangkok.
A quick note on instant gratification, because shopping these days has made bursts of happiness so easy. Like sometimes you just need a Zeka from Quetzaltenango. Am I right? But who are you going to call when the craving for the jam-filled Guatemalan pastry strikes?
Maik Chavez is probably your guy. He's part of what the Wall Street Journal is calling a cottage industry of couriers who are ferrying familiar pastries, coffees, tamales, cheese, and chilies to the 3 million Guatemalans living in the U.S. Chavez makes deliveries from remote locations throughout Guatemala to cities here, from Houston to Grand Rapids to Washington, D.C.
And buen provecho. Enjoy.
It's been around for thousands of years, and as recently as the early 1900s, tuberculosis was a leading cause of death here in the Western world. Globally, TB cases have dropped in the last several years, but not in Latin America. It has seen a worrisome jump in cases of tuberculosis. A recent study looking at six Latin American countries found that a major driver of infections is an increase in the prison populations there. Yiran Liu is an epidemiologist and public health researcher based in New Haven, Connecticut, who worked on that study.
The risk of TB has been shown to be about 10 times higher in prisons than in the general population globally.
Wow.
But this disparity is really exacerbated in Latin America, where the rates are 26 times higher in prisons. And that's in large part because of the rapid growth in the prison population in the region.
And so that's just an issue of overcrowding, driving more transmission?
Yeah, it's largely overcrowding. And also, there's a number of other tuberculosis risk factors. For example, undernutrition, smoking, alcohol or drug use, and other health factors that are disproportionately an issue among incarcerated individuals.
And just remind us what the symptoms of TB are and how serious it can be.
Yeah, so TB is a deadly disease if left untreated. The typical symptoms are prolonged cough for more than a couple of weeks, and that might have some blood in it, as well as, you know, other feverish symptoms like fatigue, fever, weight loss.
So this study looked at six countries in particular: Brazil, Colombia, Mexico, Argentina, Peru, and El Salvador. The rates of imprisonment there went up significantly in the time period you looked at. Do we know why?
Yeah, starting in the 1990s, there were increases in crime and violence and increasing public fear around crime and violence. And in response, governments really cracked down with harsh punitive policies, increasing sentences for crimes, as well as criminalizing new acts, including otherwise nonviolent or minor offenses. And this really led to a ballooning of the prison population really across the region in nearly every country in the region. And this has continued through the last couple of decades onto today. There's really alarming trends, especially recently in El Salvador, where the government has enacted a state of exception since March 2022. And now almost 2% of the population of El Salvador is incarcerated.
Wow. Are countries in Latin America dealing effectively with the spread of TB in their prison systems? Have they made any changes?
There's been varying responses across countries. Some countries have recognized this issue and initiated efforts to increase access to diagnostic testing and treatment in prisons. However, you know, I think what our study really tries to point out is that at the end of the day, it will be really challenging to tackle the crisis of TB in prisons and to make gains on the tuberculosis epidemic at large without addressing the root cause, which is the fact that we're putting so many people behind bars and exposing them to these conditions in the first place.
Is a concern in these countries that an increase in TB in prison populations will or already has spilled over into the general population?
Absolutely. And that's what we really tried to show through our study. You know, prisons are not closed populations or isolated environments. Prison staff and visitors come in and out of prisons every day and return to their communities. And we also have incarcerated individuals who are released back into their communities every day. And this combines with the nature of tuberculosis, which is a very slowly developing disease, such that someone who gets infected in prison may not actually develop the infectious form of the disease until months or years after exposure.
So there is a vaccine for tuberculosis, although its spread in the U.S. is so uncommon that people are here are not even regularly vaccinated for it. Why has it been impossible to squash this disease completely?
The vaccine is about a century old, and it is effective at preventing TB in infants and children, but it's really ineffective in TB prevention in adolescents and adults. So unfortunately, the vaccine has not been a silver bullet in reducing TB rates around the world. Mm. We do have an effective treatment that lasts about 6 months that can cure the vast majority of cases of TB. But unfortunately, access to diagnostics and treatment still is lacking in much of the world, and particularly in the most marginalized parts of the world, including in prisons.
Yiran Liu is an epidemiologist and public health researcher based in New Haven, Connecticut. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Bullfighting is most famous and most controversial in Spain, but it is also a thing in some Latin American countries. In Costa Rica, the stars of the shows aren't matadors or even the bulls. They are the members of the public who brave the rings. Jamie Fullerton headed to the capital, San Jose, to find out more.
A bull stomps into the dark brown mud of an arena in Pedregal, a district in San Jose, Costa Rica's capital city. The animal is surrounded by about 100 people on the arena ground, plus 2,800 people in the seats encircling it. The bull nails a man in blue jeans and sneakers. Its horns have been blunted and taped, but the creature uses them to shunt the man over its head. Next, the bull charges a large man, whose belly fat wobbles free from the bottom of his t-shirt as he runs. A headbutt takes the man down, but he grabs the bull in a headlock. A commentator orders him to let the beast go. Bullfighting was introduced to Costa Rica by Spanish colonists hundreds of years ago. But this event, which has become a Christmas time tradition here, is now more about audience participation than cheering for sequined matadors. Bullfighting has been hosted in San Jose as part of the huge Zapote Festival since the 1960s. The festival also features music, a horse parade and funfair rides, starting on Christmas Day and running to early January. At the same time, a similar bullfighting and festival event called Toros a la Tica takes place in Pedregal, another San Jose district. At both events, you can pay about $15 for a bullfighting arena ticket.
Hay un grupo que ustedes lo van a ver. Eso se identifica por colores. Está el rojo.
Backstage at the Pedregal Arena, I meet Wilbert Salazar Sanchez. He's a professional bullfighter and in charge of the improvisadores, the improvisers, members of the public who go in the arena with the bull. He tells me that pretty much anyone can be an improviser, as long as they don't wear impeding clothes, they sign a form to insure them against injuries, and they're not drunk. Professional bullfighters like Sanchez do rodeo-style performances at the shows, riding bucking bulls. But most of the bull sessions involve hundreds of improvisers running around the arena with a bull or two. Sometimes improvisers can win cash prizes by doing things like grabbing ribbons attached to bull horns. But mainly, The sessions just seemed to be about annoying the bull as much as possible. Just before the first Pedregal show, I meet a man wearing a bright orange T-shirt, the uniform of the regular improvisers, who return to the ring every year.
Are you an improviser?
Yeah.
I don't catch his name.
How many drinks has he had today?
Oi!
But I do catch the stench of alcohol on his breath.
Porque son los que están esperando...
Sanchez says these improvisers are the clowns of the arena. Most improvisers are men, but women get in the ring too, and the events are shown on TV. There are two medical clinics in the Pedregal complex, and Sanchez says that injuries are pretty common and that he's broken bones and injured his genitals in the past. Once, he says, someone had their ribs ripped open by a bull. Sanchez says he could look inside and see their heart beating. He says he can't explain why he still does these events after seeing things like that. It's just pure adrenaline. For one Pedregal bull session, huge red metal seesaws are brought into the arena. Improvisers use the seesaws to lift each other out of the way of the charging bull's horns.
El costarricense por naturaleza.
Alvaro Zamora Castillo is one of the commentators here. He's worked at bullfighting events for decades and documents their histories. He tells me that the first bullfighting event in Costa Rica took place in 1725. Costa Rica was colonized by Spain at that time. Long before the superhero costumes and jester hats, the bull was killed at these events, like it is in traditional Spanish bullfighting. Castillo explains that killing the bull was banned in Costa Rica in the 1960s. Humans may be in more danger than bulls at these shows, but at Pedregal I see people hit bulls with sticks. Castillo admits that these events are stressful for the bulls, but insists that outside the shows, these valuable animals live, in his words, like kings. Occasionally there are small protests against the Zapote bullfighting shows.
Well, I don't think it's humane playing with a being that evidently doesn't want to be there. I mean, I don't think they're enjoying it. They don't look like it.
Karen Eleanor works as a makeup artist using vegan products and is planning a protest for early January. She's part of a small vegan collective, a tiny mark of dissonance among widespread acceptance of these bull events in the city.
Many people, they just live their lives without contemplating this whole aspect, right? They just think it's a cultural thing. When they see it, when they read something or when they see something online about what's going on, at least they stop and think about it. Right.
After the Pedregal show, Sanchez, the improviser's leader, is covered in sweat and mud, but he's smiling. He says one improviser suffered a broken arm this afternoon. Sanchez teaches improvisers to stay on the ground and protect their heads if a bull knocks them down. But this one tried to stand and run, so the bull nailed him again. Despite this, Sanchez claims that overall, the session was more relaxed than usual. He says I should come to the evening show because it'll probably be more extreme. Sadly, tickets are already sold out. For The World, I'm Jamie Fullerton in Pedregal, Costa Rica.
Before we head out today, a few things you might have missed in the news.
India launched its first ever space docking mission earlier this week. An Indian-made rocket carried two satellites into Earth's orbit. Next week, India's space agency plans to dock the satellites together so they'll move through space in a single unit. That's a crucial step toward enabling missions that require equipment to be assembled in space.
In Zimbabwe, a missing 8-year-old boy has been found. He'd gotten lost for 5 days in a game reserve after wandering off into a wilderness area that's home to one of the densest lion populations in Africa. Fortunately, the boy is an expert camper. He survived by eating wild fruit and digging up dry riverbeds for water to drink. The search for the boy ended after park rangers spotted his fresh footprints.
And it was footprints that caught the eye of a worker at a limestone quarry in England. He was suspicious when he spotted an odd pattern of dips in the rock there. Turns out they're ancient footprints and evidence of a dinosaur highway used in prehistoric times by long-necked herbivores called sauropods. The discovery offers a new glimpse into how these creatures moved. The footprints were so well preserved, one scientist said he could see how the mud squelched out from under the dino's feet. Pretty cool.
It sure is. And that is where we'll have to leave it this Thursday. The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Join us right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. And by FJC, a foundation of philanthropic funds serving the nonprofit sector with donor-advised funds, fiscal sponsorship, bridge lending, and more. FJC.org. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.